How will immigration look different under the Biden administration? Hello and welcome to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. Biden launched a series of executive orders focused on immigration in his first days in office. What is the future for DACA, TPS, and border security look like? We've assembled a panel conversation and we're going to take your calls. Plus, Emilio Sanchez is known for his beautiful architectural paintings. The United States Postal Service recently created a forever stamp in his honor, and we'll learn more about the Cuban-American life story. And finally,
I saw this woman step onto my property, and the next morning the orchid was gone.
This month for the Sundial Book Club, we were reading The Orchid Thief by Susan Orlean. Why are people in South Florida so obsessed with this rare flower? All of that today on Sundial. First, the news. Hello and welcome to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. Thanks so much for joining us. Well, with the new administration comes a new approach to the issue of immigration. In one of his first acts, President Joe Biden issued an executive order calling for the Secretary of Homeland Security to preserve and fortify DACA. He also urged Congress to allow other immigrants living illegally in the U.S. to become candidates for residency in 5 years and for citizenship within 8 years. Now, how much of this immigration reform is possible, even with Democratic control of the House and Senate? We're speaking with Tim Padgett, WLRN America's correspondent, and Vilma Petrush, a professor of American government at Miami-Dade College. Much of her research is on international relations. Vilma, Tim, welcome to the program. Really appreciate it.
Hi, Luis. How are you?
Thank you for inviting me.
Definitely. And we want to hear from you, you know, what you hope to see in the issue of immigration, what you hope to see from this new administration. Maybe you're someone who depends on TPS or DACA. What have the last few years been like for you? What do you hope to see change or move forward in the next couple of years? Give us a call, 800-743-9576. That's 800-743-WLRN. Find us on social media at WLRN Sundial. You can also email us, sundial@wlrnnews.org. Tim, let's start with, I guess, the first story, really, that we've seen in the switch between administrations with Venezuela. We saw former President Donald Trump give Venezuelans living here in the United States deferred enforced departure. DED basically gives Venezuelans protection from deportation. This is not TPS, but help us understand the difference. What did he do?
Well, DED, deferred enforced departure, as you just mentioned, at least under the executive order that President Trump issued last week, it would give all Venezuelans living in the U.S., it would suspend deportation of undocumented Venezuelans living in the U.S. for 18 months. It would also give them the opportunity to work legally here during that time. But it's not quite to the level of the other kind of deportation protection you just mentioned, temporary protected status or TPS, which is a bit more of a bona fide immigration status for people here who have, like people who get DED, they have escaped or they are here because they're being protected from natural or political disasters back in their home countries. TPS tends to give the person a little bit better chance of perhaps a path to something like residency or citizenship. As I said, it tends to be a more bona fide immigration status, whereas DED is just sort of telling the person, we were going to deport you, but we're going to give you some relief for you know, 12 or 18 months.
Vilma, how did Venezuelans in South Florida respond to that?
And of course, there was a lot of, I would say, enthusiasm, because the truth is we were waiting for that for a long time. And what was surprising was the last minute decision, executive order by the president, even though we have an actual possibility, as Tim was saying, of the TPS, you know, because there was a support actually in the House, and then it was blocked at the level of the Senate. It was denounced as such. By Bob Menendez, Senator Menendez, because the truth, we were expecting something more of a solution that was actually bipartisan. And I would say that we interpret that, at least some people, I would say there was enthusiasm, as I said, on one side, But some other people like me, you know, that have been observing what is happening with the policy of the former administration towards Venezuela, we found that a way to undermine what was being already announced by the forthcoming Biden administration regarding Venezuela, because the TPS was already, you know, on site as a possibility, actually. Yeah. And we knew that that was going to be a more permanent solution, because we knew that people in the bipartisan way, people in Congress were supposed to be and were going to support that possibility. I would say that we thought basically this was basically a last minute 11th hour order in order to undermine the policy of President Biden. And on the other hand, it didn't provide actually the safety that many Venezuelans need. TPS is something stronger. It has actually bipartisan support. And maybe, as Tim was saying, it will guarantee a more stability to a community that has been actually looking for this kind of solution for
a long time. And you keep saying we, because you are Venezuelan, you escaped. Yes. So this is very personal to you. Tim, she says that Trump leaves this, he does this to sort of hurt Biden. Was this really to hurt Biden, or was this just a way for him to say to Venezuelans, who a lot of them voted for him, to say, hey, thanks?
Well, all of that. As one Venezuelan-American told me in our Latin America report today, what Trump may have been trying to do is, as she said, steal the spotlight from Biden, knowing that Biden had promised during his campaign to grant Venezuelans, either through executive order or getting a bill passed through Congress, to grant them TPS. There was perhaps an urge on the part of Trump to steal the spotlight from Biden in that regard and grant Venezuelans the lesser protection of DED as he was walking out of the White House. But as you point out, there were a lot of political components to this, one of them being, as you point out, to thank Venezuelans, the majority of whom in Venezuela did vote for him, because they favor his policies toward Venezuela, his attempts to overthrow the Maduro, the socialist regime there.
So, but why do it the last minute, as Vilma said, the 11th hour? Is it really just to get to Biden? He couldn't have done that earlier?
No, I believe there's another very important political component to this, and that was, as again, you can read in our Latin America report today, to help Florida Republicans as we move ahead here. Yeah. They need to preserve their own standing. Both senators, Republican senators Rick Scott and Marco Rubio, and the Republican congressional delegation here in South Florida, they need to preserve their standing with Venezuelan voters as we move ahead. And this was a way for Trump to sort of help them as well.
Yeah. Again, talking about immigration today, and we're looking under the Biden presidency. What do we expect the Biden presidency to be on this issue? What is he going to do? What are the challenges that he faces? And we're talking about really anything with immigration. We started by talking about Venezuela. That was the more recent news. But, you know, we want to talk about TPS. We want to talk about Haiti. We want to talk about DACA. We'll talk about a little bit of everything today. We're going to try to stick it all in there. 800-743-9576, or you can find us on social media at WLRN Sundial. I want to go to the phones, and we'll switch things up here. We'll come back to Venezuela in a minute, but I've got Lisa, who is from, Lisa, I believe you're a Canadian, but you're affected by DACA, right?
So, yes, we have been here for about 10 years. So we started off on e-visas, which is the investor visa to come to the United States to work and set up a business. So we were on that for 10 years. Now, then Trump took over. I'm not a fan, and I will specifically say that, because of his policies. And as being an immigrant, we are directly affected in such an inverse way. So one of the things that is really important for people to know is that it's not just every immigrant is affected by every single policy that he went through. You know, I'm considered I have my second degree. I'm extremely well-educated. I'm Canadian. You know, I am what he long ago said, you know, we want all the Norwegians in, you know, equivalency of that. And the suffering that every immigrant has had under this system is unbelievable. At the end of our E2 visa, we personally received a notification because the E visa at the time was locked in under the DACA program, and we were given 30 days to leave the country. At that point, we had to sell our cars, sell our houses, get ready to pull our kids out of school, And then 2 weeks later, we got a, oops, we're sorry, we didn't mean to do that. You're still okay. And we got that on two separate occasions.
Hmm. Mm-hmm. So right now, where are you at?
So right now in our visa process, we have applied and we are living now currently under O visas. The O visa is it's the special visa for scientists and for people who are highly educated. But we have been turned down on two separate occasions for invalid reasons, basically as if I had done what the administration had done to me, I would be kicked out of the country immediately. And we are currently scheduled right now to leave September 1st, 2021, unless things change for us.
So really for the last quite a few years now, you've been on that edge, not knowing what's going to happen.
Four solid years of living under PTSD, where any day you're afraid that you're going to get that next letter, and then 2 weeks later, oops, we're sorry. You know,
Lisa,
go ahead.
No, hold on 1 second for me. Tim, so Biden has called for Homeland Security to fortify DACA. What's the latest on that?
Well, the latest was that the Trump administration, as it had several times during the administration, they lost in federal court their attempts to get rid of DACA, essentially. And we didn't really see them. The last incidence of them losing in federal court was just a few months ago. And I don't think we didn't see them make any appreciable effort to fight that. So right now, DACA is still alive. What President Biden is saying now, or what's being asked of him now, is to fortify it, to strengthen it, to make it more permanent, to make sure that these dreamers, as they're called, the people who were brought into this country as young children through no fault of their own, to make sure that these DACA recipients now have that a legal status here permanently. I think that's the next step.
Yeah. Lisa, you know what? I wanted to get your information so we can be in touch with you. But so you have right now until September. That's the plan. So living under this PTSD, are you making that plan? Do you have that plan on what comes next? Or is it just let's hope that, you know, things change?
So the triple lawyers that we've visited and have spoken to on a variety of occasions have told us that, you know, within the first 90 days, which we all know is that Biden has the ability to reverse most of the immigration or some of the immigration effects that Trump had initiated over the last 4 years.
Yeah.
But taking into effect of that is that you also have to think about all of the personnel they need to rehire, all the people they need to train. So right now, getting into a permanent residency situation, which we just looked up the day that the inauguration day, it was a 14 to 45 month wait. Typically, during the first years of the administration and in the Obama administration, It was a 7 to 9 month wait.
Mm.
And this is 14 to 45 days. So 14 to 45 months, which means that you cannot exit the country. God forbid somebody dies or something happens and you need to leave the country.
Right.
You can say goodbye to that.
Coming back, right. Lisa, I'm going to put you on hold. I'd like to get your information, like to stay in touch with you and follow up on you with this story. I really appreciate you sharing with us today.
No, thank you. And I just want all the listeners to know that, you know, immigrants come in many different colors, many different sizes, many different fares. But in the end, Americans have no idea of the toll, the financial strain, the emotional strain that immigrants, no matter who we are, we all go through the same horribleness and have been affected over the last 4 years.
Hmm. Lisa, again, thanks. And please hold for me. Don't go anywhere. Again, talking about immigration on today's program, I'm talking with WLRN's America's correspondent, Tim Padgett, and Vilma Petrasch, professor of American government at Miami-Dade College. We were talking about Venezuela. We're going to cover as much as we can today. Just coming back before we go to break, coming back to Venezuela, if I may, Vilma, I wanted to ask you this, because Tim and I talked about this many times during this past election. It was the approach that Republicans took, you know, during the election, which was, of course, to call Biden a socialist, to link him to people like Maduro and, of course, to Cuba. But what do you see as for Biden the challenge? He's got to look at all of these different issues, different countries, you have different countries that had TPS, some countries with very different immigration policies that we've had over the years with them, like Cuba, for example. What do you see as the biggest challenge for him, but also trying to rebrand himself and rebrand his party as not socialist, but maybe on the side of the folks that he wants to help?
Well, I have to say that one of the painful experiences that I had in the campaign was precisely the way that my people, people from Cuba and people from Nicaragua were manipulated with this communist boogeyman, you know, like the Biden administration was a socialist administration. And even though we knew, I mean, people that have the common sense of understanding what the centrist policy was representing, but, you know, they were playing with those feelings. And let me go back to something that Tim was saying before. It's true, and this last minute decision was precisely to, you know, reinforce, you know, this kind of policies and help the people in 2022 that will go to re-election and things like that. But the truth is the solution for the Venezuelan situation wasn't there. I don't believe that even this kind of thing that happened for 18 months was a solution. The Venezuelan situation is a complicated one. And I would say with the former policy, actually, we got it more complicated because we went through a sanction process that actually worsened the situations for many Venezuelans, and the regime is stronger right now. So I would say the challenge in order to solve the Venezuelan situation is even bigger today than it was when the Trump administration started. I know we have a humanitarian crisis. I know we have a security problem in Venezuela. We know that. Latin America knows that. I would say Latin American nations, if we have a coordinated policy, we may deal together in a multilateral approach to what is going on in Venezuela. But I would say the situation now is much worse than it was, let's say, 4 years ago. And, so I don't know if it's going to be easy for the Biden administration, and more in the face of the many challenges this administration is facing, including challenges inside this country. I know it's going to be complicated.
Tim, is it more, as she's saying, more complicated? So Biden isn't going to continue Obama, you know, policies towards Venezuela. He's going to have something different?
Well, I think you mean he's not going to follow or continue Trump policies. Is that what you meant?
Well, no. I mean, with Venezuela, does he go back to how Obama was dealing with Venezuela, or does he have to go another route?
No, I don't think he goes back to either of those, to either how Obama approached Venezuela or how Trump approached Venezuela, because Obama really was not that effective when it came to Venezuela, and he didn't have that much time. Trump, in his 4 years, did some pretty bold and aggressive things to pressure the authoritarian socialist regime in Venezuela. But in the end, as Vilma just pointed out, President Maduro there seems more entrenched now than he did 4 years ago. So both, I think in both instances, we've seen failure. And so Biden now has to set a reset button on Venezuela and find some new approach to getting that regime to soften up and allow democracy to return to the country, allow new elections. As Vilma pointed out, I think they're going to have to take an approach that really focuses more on getting a multilateral international coalition involved in squeezing this regime into doing the right thing. That's going to take time. But he is going to have to find a new approach. And as Vilma says, that's going to be a real challenge for him, especially as he's got to convince Latinos in places here like South Florida that he's not, quote, soft on these communists and socialists in Latin America.
Still talking about the issue of immigration on today's program, and we'd like to hear your thoughts. And again, Venezuela, Cuba, we're going to talk about TPS, we're going to talk about DACA, we're going to talk about a lot of things. We'd like to hear from you. You know, if those things were affecting you, what life has been like for you over the last few years? What do you hope to see under this new administration? The number is 800-743-9576. That's 800-743-WLRN, or find us on social media at WLRN Sundial. We're going to take a break. Come back. Take more of your calls. Welcome back to Sundial on WLRN, and we're going to continue our conversation with our panel on immigration issues, the immigration debate under the new Biden-Harris administration. What is that going to look like? We're talking with WLRN's America's correspondent, Tim Padgett, and Vilma Petrasch, who's the professor of American government at Miami-Dade College. The number again, 800-743-9576. We'd like to hear your thoughts on what the immigration policy should be now moving forward. I wanted to go to Maria Rodriguez. She's the executive director of the Florida Immigrant Coalition. She had something to say.
Maria Rodriguez, on behalf of the members of the Florida Immigrant Coalition, executive director. We, immigrant families and advocates, are thrilled to turn the page on this very dark chapter of American history and step forward towards whatever is needed to get the reform that will help us call Florida a true home for all. We're grateful for the executive orders, given that 500,000 U.S. citizen kids have had a parent detained and deported. And whether it's fueled by racism, profit, or fear, we need to help these families step into the light to their maximum potential for the benefit of all of us.
And again, that's Maria Rodriguez, executive director of the Florida Immigrant Coalition. Again, the number 800-743-9576. I want to go to the phones. I've got Hans in Fort Lauderdale. Hans, thanks for waiting. Welcome to the program. You had something you want to chime in about the issue of socialism in Venezuela. What's on your mind?
Right. Well, I know a lot of Venezuelans and Central Americans, and what I was hearing is they definitely wanted to vote for Republican because they were so afraid under Biden this country will become the next Venezuela or the next Cuba.
Yes.
And I think those groups need to have some organization who is educating and explaining the Venezuelans, Latinos, etc. What it really, I mean, it's impossible for this country to become another Venezuela or another Cuba or whatever because of the setup, the way the government layers are set up.
Right. It's an education in understanding what socialism is. And it's easy to throw the word around, but understanding what socialism is.
And there's, social democrat or socialism, and there are different layers and big differences between
right.
them.
Right. Yeah, Hans, thank you so much for the call. Tim, we talked about this before. It's this idea of, you know, what some people view as socialist, they may think of Cuba or Venezuela, and other people view Sweden or something like that.
Right. Hans is right. Different layers, if you want to call it. I mean, look, the reality is the United States itself is a hybrid of capitalism and socialism. We have Wall Street. We also have Medicare. Okay. Those are two examples of those two principles working in tandem, which has made this country so great. And I think that's one of the things that is, as Hans points out, is missing in the, I think, the social and political education these days in the Latino community, to point out that, as Hans just said, it's very, very hard for the United States to become Cuba or Venezuela because we have our institutions function so much better in that sense. And that kind of extremism could never, poison our system to that extent.
Now, you mentioned Cuba. I want to get to Cuba real quickly. And Tim, I'll start with you. Again, does Biden go back to what was happening when he was with Obama? Or does he have to approach Cuba in a whole new way?
Not in a whole new way, but in a different way. There was the feeling under Obama, as even among people who agreed with his engagement, his normalization policy towards Cuba, there was a feeling at the end of his administration that this had all been too much of a one-way street, that the United States was giving a lot of concessions. For example, we took Cuba off the State Department's list of state sponsors of terrorism, but yet with the feeling that we got very little in return from Cuba, from the Cuban regime, particularly in the very important area of human rights. Reform. So I think Obama is going to have to take a more cautious approach, perhaps, than Obama did. He will engage Trump. He will engage Cuba. He'll break with Trump's non-engagement and isolationist policies towards Cuba. But I think he'll do it in a much more cautious manner.
Yeah, Vilma, what about you? What did you see in the attitude of Cubans here in South Florida under Trump, and how does Biden move forward?
Okay. I have to say that there is a lot of pain in this community. You know, I have been here since 2004, and I have seen and I had felt the pain, and of course I had felt the pain of my own community. So I understand that, as Tim was saying, if we're gonna have a policy, and I understand that we are talking about people that vote, okay? We understand that. Besides that part, which is very important politically here, there is a pain in a community that we have to take into consideration. There are human rights violations. There is the destruction of entire societies, the destruction of, you know, lives of people that are real people, you know, that are suffering the consequences of these regimes. So we have to be careful how we approach the policy, understanding that, of course, it's not that we cannot have a different kind of policy, like trying to find a way to actually make a real solution, if possible, to this kind of difficult situation with regimes that have been ingrained for so long and that have actually displaced their own people, because this is what happened with Cubans and is happening today with Venezuelans. Actually, this kind of regime created the worst, I mean, in the case of Venezuela, refugee crisis that we have in the hemisphere. Yep. We have actually more than 5 million people outside Venezuela. So we know there is a lot of pain. So in order to have a policy that make those regimes try to, you know, modify or have some kind of change, we need to consider the pain of the community and the kind of, you know, criminal behavior they have. So I don't know if this is easy to do, but what I say, it has to be a sensible policy.
What about this, though? Because one of the things that we saw under the Trump administration was the fact that he was feeding off of that fear and anger towards immigrants. He doubled down on that. And of course, talking about building the wall and the names that he had for many countries that we won't repeat. But you had that, he tried to have that strongman attitude towards Cuba and towards Venezuela. Do you see under Biden that we have to go in the opposite direction, have a complete open arms kind of policy? We welcome all of you back. And then still have a strong arm type of policy towards Cuba and Venezuela. What do you think Biden, what's his next move have to be?
Are you asking me?
Yeah, Vilma, I want to hear your thoughts on that.
Okay, let me tell you something. We have to have a balance, of course. We do have a problem here with immigrant communities. Like Lisa was saying, I am a professor in Miami Dade College, and I have had DACA students suffering the uncertainty of being citizens without papers, you know, because the truth is they don't know any other country. This is a humanitarian solution, actually, a humanitarian solution that we have to make as Americans. And on the other hand, we have to consider that immigrants have been so important in order to build this society. We are a pluribus unum, you know, of out of many one. We are a nation of diversity. We cannot deny that. And immigrants have made a strong contribution. So we do have to have a solution. We have, of course, we have to be careful also with the kind of people, because, you know, we have threats also that we have to consider.
Right.
But
that's
the
correct.
Truth is that at the same time, we have millions of people here in the United States.
And
that
I apologize.
Actually need a solution for the life. They have this, I mean, they have a life, they have kids that are citizens, and they don't have a solution for them. I don't think that's fair. I mean, we need to have, as I said, a balance. We can have a strong borders. We can have a strong, and I would say, firm, a solid immigration policy, and at the same time finding solution for people that are contributors to the greatness of this nation.
I
think we have to have that balance, definitely.
Let me, before I go back to the phones, Tim, you have a Democratic House and Senate. What do you think Biden can accomplish?
I think he can accomplish perhaps more than Obama did on the immigration front, but it's still going to be tough. He's only got 50 senators there, plus Kamala Harris. And on a lot of these measures, it's going to take 60 senators to get things passed. I believe, like the immigration bill, the very bold immigration bill that he's proposed, the U.S. Citizenship Act of 2021, which would give undocumented people in this country an 8-year path to eventually citizenship. We haven't seen a comprehensive immigration reform proposal like that since 1986, when President Reagan offered his amnesty to that cohort of undocumented people.
And already some Republicans calling that an amnesty they don't want to give. Again, the number 800-743-9576. I want to go to Delray Beach, and I want to go to Sherry, who volunteers to teach immigrant children. Sherry, welcome to the program.
Hello, how are you today?
I'm doing very good. Hope you're doing well. Tell me a little bit about what are you doing?
Oh, what I've done for the last 14-plus years is I've helped people become citizens in this country. I have worked with adults and children to help them better their English as well.
And you get them ready for the citizenship test, right?
That is correct, yes. I've had thousands upon thousands upon thousands of applicants come to me to get help. I work through South Florida, in a major county in South Florida. I don't want to say it on the air. Mm-hmm. But the things that I found that I dealt with mostly were people that came from South America that wanted to become citizens in this country. Some people actually even have lived here for, I've had a couple that lived here for over 50 years and never became a citizen, all of a sudden wanted to become a citizen. So I've dealt with everything
wow.
you could think of.
That's a long time. Sherry, a curious question for you then is, you know, what do you tend to hear from folks about our debate in this country over immigration? Here, these are folks who want to become citizens, they're going through the process, but what do they usually tell you? What are their thoughts about, you know, the debate that we have here and how we handle it?
Okay, I could tell you a little bit about this. It saddens me a little bit, and I'll tell you why. Because the people that largely come from these South American countries, I don't think they have a lot of money. Some of them may have money. A select amount have I've worked with had money and ties to the government, believe it or not. But largely, a lot of the group doesn't have money. They come here because they want the benefits.
Yeah.
They come straight out. That's the first thing they tell me. They feel that they have the right to have the benefits because this is a free country. I've heard this millions upon millions of times. Of course, I can't really say anything to them. You know, I try to explain to them what a free country means.
Yeah.
And it doesn't mean that everything that they get here is free to them. They don't get that right away. That's a very important point that I wanted to make today.
Thank
what is a free country?
You know what? That's a good point. I apologize, Sherry, because I have to, only because of time. That's an excellent point, and I appreciate you bringing that up. And I know, you know, other people I've known who've worked with immigrants, yeah, there are people who come here because they think there are a lot of free programs and a lot of free opportunities. And yeah, their definition of freedom is very different than ours. They think free, we know. No lunch is free. There's no free lunches. There's always something. There's always a cost. Sherry, thank you so much for the call. I wanted, Tim, come back to you real quickly. The other thing I wanted to touch on just briefly, one of the ugly things that we saw under the Trump administration was, of course, and we did see this to an extent, you know, under Obama, but it was the separating of families coming over the border. And of course, the big debate when we were putting children in these camps. How does Biden handle that? Do you think that we've seen the last of those?
Oh, I definitely think we've seen the last of that under Biden, for sure, particularly since there was such, even amongst many Republicans in this country, there was just a very bitter backlash against that family separation policy and just the cruelty of it. So, yeah, I think we can be very confident that we won't see that sort of thing under Biden again.
But does Biden, because under Obama, let's not forget, Obama was known as the deporter in chief. And so does he have to, does that carry on over on him? Does he continue any of those policies?
Here's one of the big differences to point out is that under Obama, yes, you did have a lot of deportations. He did get that moniker. But most of the deportations that his administration pursued had to do with people who had, you know, committed felonies here, who had done things that frankly merited their removal from this country. Under the Trump administration, it was much more indiscriminate. People who you would not have thought before would get nabbed by Immigration and Customs Enforcement, for example. People who were very law-abiding, people who were making contributions to the community, they were caught up in the dragnet as well. That's the key difference, I think, between the Obama and Trump deportation approaches. So I think that's an important distinction to make.
And then just briefly, Tim, on TPS, you had TPS for so many different groups, Haitians, especially here in South Florida. What happens now? Because Haitian TPS, I think, ends in a year.
It was supposed to end a year. Haitian TPS, Nicaraguan, Honduran, El Salvadoran, for example, all of those TPS situations are right now sort of held up in federal court, meaning the case is against renewing Their TPS status is being held up in federal court, and it's looking as though it's looking very good for groups like Haitians in those courts right now. And I think now that a new administration is in Washington, you're going to see efforts either in the White House or in Congress to make those TPS statuses for those groups more permanent.
Yeah. Vilma, in just 30 seconds, what do you hope to see in the first 100 days under the Biden administration?
I would say a more coherent policy in immigration, because the truth is we haven't had that. As Tim was saying, with the Obama administration, as you know, the first term, he actually invested his time basically on his policies on ACA, what I mean is Obamacare. But then the immigration wasn't a priority, although they have the resources to do that. And then we had an administration later with the Trump administration that actually was so much anti-immigrant that caused a lot of damage and actually put, I would say, the image of the United States in a very bad shape regarding, this separation of families with the kids and the cages and all this kind of ugly situation that we saw. I would say we need a coherent policy, and I don't expect that we have, solution for the millions of immigrants, the 50 million, but at least a good number of them, like the DACA people, the DACA immigrants, that they need to have a solution for that. I expect to see that actually happening.
And I know we try to cover so many things in one show, but we're going to come back. We're going to talk about each one of those things in depth so we can really, because there's so much to cover. I want to thank again Vilma Petrosh, Professor of American Government at Miami-Dade College, and WLRN's America's correspondent, Tim Padgett. Vilma, Tim, thank you so much for the time.
Thank you, Lewis.
And you can continue this conversation. We'd love to hear more from you on our Facebook or Twitter at WLRN Sundial. Again, we'll come back and talk about all of these topics in a future date. Well, still to come, the Postal Service is paying tribute to an iconic Cuban-American artist. You're going to learn more about Emilio Sanchez. Welcome back to Sundial on WLRN. Well, the U.S. Postal Service is featuring a Cuban-American visual artist for the first time in a series of forever stamps. Emilio Sanchez is known for his architectural paintings with their bright colors and extreme light contrast. He also has numerous works that show his Cuban heritage and his very long life in New York City. Dr. Victor Dupuy is a lecturer at the University of Miami School of Architecture. He studied Sanchez's life and work, and he recently published a book about him. Now, just a note, one of the paintings featured in the Forever Stamps is in the University of Miami Low Art Museum's permanent collection. Dr. Dupuy, welcome to the program.
Thank you, Lewis. Nice to be here.
Oh, great to have you. So let me ask you this. When did you first encounter Emilio Sanchez's work?
It was about 7 years ago, and it was really by accident. I often say he found me. I was living in New York, in Connecticut, teaching in New York, and I was doing research at the Metropolitan Museum of Art. And my wife, who Jill Dupuy, who's the director of the Low Art Museum at that time, was the director of another art museum. And we were taking a group of benefactors to Cuba to study the art and architecture on the island. So I went to the Met and I said, well, let's see what they have on Cuba. And the first thing that came up was this pencil drawing that of a rural shack on the island that struck me. And I asked myself, who is this? And it said Emilio Sanchez, and I'd never heard of him. But what really struck me was that it was 1959. And, Castro was already in power. And here was an artist in 1959 touring the rural countryside of Cuba and producing drawings of the rustic buildings. And so I searched further at the Met and found that Emilio had given 250 works in 1964, all of Cuba at the time from the 1950s, and none of it had ever been cataloged. So it just, the project was just perfect.
Yeah,
it just fell into my lap.
Even
it was just a blessing.
As you said, not a well-known artist. You're in the art world and you didn't know him. I didn't know about him either. And I'd studied art. But how do you describe him to folks who've never seen his work? I mean, I tried to briefly at the beginning here, but how would you describe it?
Well, I describe him first as a social, his early phase as a social realist. He came out of this New York Art Students League education, where he was taught to observe and depict the world around him. And so he was a travel artist in Latin America, the Caribbean, Cuba, and also later in life in New York. And he was observing and documenting urban change, but he was capturing not just the buildings, but the landscapes, the people, the daily customs, what you might call the vernacular. So he wasn't, you know, painting the monumental themes of Western art or history, nor was he engaged in the New York abstract expressionism, though his work is surprisingly geometric, which is very Cuban, by the way. No. So I see him as a modern travel observer, mobile artist. There's a beautiful French word called flâneur, a kind of mobile observer, a saunterer. It's a uniquely modern phenomenon. And so that's how I would put him.
What do you think about the fact that the U.S. Postal Service is dedicating four of his paintings to Forever Stamps? Again, not someone who was not that well known.
Last year they came out with a series for a Japanese-American woman named Ruth Asawa from San Francisco. And, you know, she's a phenomenal artist as well, who, like Emilio, falls through the cracks. And so I think that the USPS is really doing a great service to our country by bringing to light these immigrant artists that deserve much greater attention than they've been given. And the fact that Emilio is the first Cuban-American visual artist speaks a great deal to the excellence of his work and the hard. He was such a dedicated artist. So I think it's wonderful.
What do you think about the pieces they chose?
Well, you know, what's wonderful about them all is that they're variations on windows, awnings, and sort of shutters that are semi-open or semi-closed. In a way, when you look at the full panel, they look like stamps being removed from a stamp page. It's just really beautiful the way they look like just being peeled off. It's brilliant. It's actually absolutely brilliant. Very catching. I mean, you know.
Do you think that, I mean, when you make the choice, because I mean, the other thing too is this, I mean, you think about, the U.S.-Cuba relations, and yes, he is from Cuba, though he, you know, came to the United States and spent a lot of time studying here, went back, but then after the revolution never did go back. But, do you think that something like that ever should even come up in the debate as when we're picking an artist, or whether it's an artist or a writer or someone famous for their work, should that even matter? Should the politics, the history, ever come into play?
You know, this is a funny thing about timing, because I only became involved with the USPS very recently. In fact, my wife knew about it long before I did, because she was securing permissions for the loan of the work from the Lowe. So she didn't even tell me. But this had been in the planning for several years. So it really doesn't have anything to do with politics of the time, because it takes so long for these stamps, these series, to be approved and getting all the legal work done. I see it like the Ruth Asawa. They made a decision long ago to bring to light great Americans, immigrant Americans that deserve attention. And and if you look at the way they unveil these stamps and their date of, it's called the DOI, date of issue ceremony, they don't like to have politicians around. So yeah. They really remove it from that realm.
Again, I'm talking with Victor Dupuy. He is a lecturer at the University of Miami School of Architecture, and he has studied the life and the works of Emilio Sanchez. Sanchez is the first Cuban-American visual artist to be recognized in a series of Forever Stamps by the U.S. Postal Service. You know what, Victor, how was Emilio treated by his contemporaries? How did the art world treat him while he was alive?
Well, very young, in the 1950s, so when he was in his 30s, he was getting quite a bit of recognition in Cuba as the revolution was taking form. And in fact, because he was not an abstract artists in the tradition of, say, the French Impressionists or the New York Abstract Expressionists, the communists really liked his work because it had this kind of indigenous Cubanness, Cubanidad, as we say, and they loved it. They loved it. And he was, in 1959, he had several exhibitions in Cuba, but that was not his concern, and he was not going to be a part of that. And he was a New Yorker, and in 1960, he left. But New York was a bit of a struggle for him because the New York world was really run by what we call the modern millionaires at the time, the Rockefellers, the Guggenheims, the Whitneys, and the curators at MoMA and all these museums were pushing abstract expressionism. So Emilio was a kind of, not a favorite of the art scene in New York in the 60s or 50s, but he had a tremendous success elsewhere in the United States. He exhibited quite a lot in Florida. He exhibited in Puerto Rico. He exhibited in Paris, London, throughout Latin America, Colombia. So he was well recognized, but New York was always a kind of challenge for him that I think hopefully now will not be.
Something interesting too about him is that he left behind the Emilio Sanchez Foundation, which helps fund art scholarships, but also research relating to eye and eye diseases. Why? Why was that important to him?
Emilio had a detached retina, I believe, in the early 1980s. And so he had a what's called a scleral buckle placed in his left eye, which, curiously, I had the same phenomenon. So I know exactly the problem. So, yes, he created a foundation just before he died. And the foundation is no longer technically operating. They de-access all of the works. They place them in museums and collections throughout the country, throughout the world. And they publish several books, exhibitions. And now the foundation exists to just promote anything that's going on. I would note that they also contributed significantly to the Cintas Foundation that supports Cuban artists, musicians, writers, and architects here in Miami for very many years. So the foundation was really set up to promote Emilio and to promote Cuban art in general. And of course, his gratitude to ophthalmology resulted in donations for that.
As you were putting your work together, you know, in all your research of Emilio's life and his works, as you're putting that book together, what were you thinking about how you wanted to, you know, what kind of light you wanted to shine on him, how you wanted people to see him and his life?
Well, you know, not much had been known about his early youth studies and experiences in the 1940s and 50s. Much is known since he left Cuba. So part of the project was to bring to light, and also in Mexico, because he spent, his stepfather founded an art school in Mexico. So there were chapters that were missing. But most importantly, I thought that there was a chance, and I still believe it, to rewrite or to contribute to the history of Cuban modernism in ways that have not yet been fully fleshed out.
Mm.
Emilio was an important figure in Cuba in the 50s.
Yeah.
And that's just something that is not sufficiently recognized.
Well, he is now at least recognized for some of his work forever, because he is the first Cuban-American visual artist to be recognized in the new series of Forever Stamps by the U.S. Postal Service. I want to thank our guest, Dr. Victor Dupuy. He is a lecturer at the University of Miami School of Architecture. Check out more about his work on Emilio Sanchez on our social media at WLRN Sundial. Dr. Dupuy, thank you so much for the time. I really appreciate the insight.
Thank you, Louis. My pleasure.
And that's our program for this Tuesday, January 26. Coming up tomorrow on Sundial, it's National Holocaust Remembrance Day. We're going to return to our conversation with survivor Anita Carl. She's dedicated her elder years to educating young people about the Holocaust. And I wanted to mention, we, of course, for the Sundial Book Club for this month, we have been reading Susan Orlean's The Orchid Thief. That's a story that follows John LaRoche, a very colorful orchid collector who often finds himself on the wrong side of the law. We're going to bring you our conversation with two orchid lovers as well as two readers from the book club. You can always join the book club. Just go to Facebook, look up Sundial Book Club. We'd love to have you join. Now, you know what? I want to tell you what we're going to be reading for the month of February. Get ready to write this down so you can go out and get your copy now. We are going to be reading Karen Russell's Swamplandia. The novel exists in a world where a theme park exists in the Everglades. I haven't read the book yet, so I'm really excited. If you have, let us know what you think about it, but join the book club and get your copy now so we can start talking about it. Again, we're reading Karen Russell's Swamplandia for the month of February. Well, again, I'm Luis Hernandez. As always, you can find us online, WLRN.org. Just look up Sundial or on Facebook or Twitter. Tell us what you think of the show at WLRN Sundial. As always, be safe, be good to each other. We'll talk to you live tomorrow.